Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Hundreds of Chinese diplomats are in Washington this week to take part in the 7th U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue to discuss issues such as cybersecurity and maritime tensions. VOA's Victor Beatty reports a China scholar describes the relationship between the world's top two economies as complicated, but one where differences can be managed through ongoing engagement.
U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby describes this as a big week for U.S.-China relations.
We are looking to expand our bilateral cooperation on many global challenges such as climate change, development, humanitarian assistance, pandemic response, and ocean conservation. We'll also have the chance to coordinate U.S. and Chinese policies on regional issues like Iran, Iraq, and Syria, North Korea, and Afghanistan. And we will also address areas where we have ongoing differences, such as maritime disputes, cybersecurity, and human rights.
He says while the two countries disagree on many points, they recognize there are many areas for mutually beneficial cooperation. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said the United States will rely on a combination of military and non-military tools to counter Russian aggression in Ukraine. Spoke Monday in Berlin before traveling to Estonia for meetings with the defense ministers of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which were forcibly incorporated into the former Soviet Union. Carter said the United States will contribute special operations forces, intelligence, and other military assets to a new NATO rapid reaction force, in part to help Europe counter any Russian aggression. This is VOA News. Kurdish militia fighters and other rebels are reportedly 50 kilometers north of the Syrian city of Raqqa, which Islamic State fighters claim as their capital. Meanwhile, there is growing friction between Druze residents in southern Syria and factions trying to capture ground from government forces. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Kurdish fighters fire automatic weapons against Islamic State positions near the self-proclaimed Islamic State capital of Raqqa in northern Syria. Witnesses say the Kurds captured the town of Ain Issa, 50 kilometers north of Raqqa, as well as the strategic military base 93. Arab media also reported U.S.-led coalition airstrikes on Islamic State positions north of Raqqa allowed Kurdish forces to advance on several fronts. Retired Iraqi General Abdelkarim Khalif said on Al Arabiya TV that Iran, Iraq, and Syria share borders and need to stop the flow of foreign fighters between pockets of territory controlled by the terrorist Islamic State group. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Rwandan officials have confirmed that the government's intelligence chief, General Karenzi Karekye, has been arrested in Britain. Rwanda's Justice Minister, Johnson Busenge, has told VOA that Karekye has been arrested and the government is seeking clarification from Britain on the reason for the arrest. British authorities say Karekye was arrested on a European arrest warrant on behalf of Spain, where he is wanted in connection with war crimes against civilians. The governor of the U.S. state of Carolina, South Carolina, has called for the Confederate flag to be removed from the grounds of the state capitol, while the world's largest retailer, Walmart, announced it would stop selling the flag in stores or online. Governor Nikki Haley reversed her previous position on the flag Monday, saying that while the flag is an integral part of the state's past, it no longer represents the future. She acknowledged that to many it is a symbol of a brutally oppressive past. She said if state lawmakers do not take up the flag issue, she would call them back for a special legislative session. The growing backlash against the controversial flag comes in the wake of last week's deadly shooting of 9 members of an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina. At least 40 people were killed in Nigeria during recent attacks by suspected Boko Haram militants. Witnesses and security sources say the attacks occurred in 2 neighboring villages in Borno State on Monday afternoon and also on Tuesday morning. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations is expanding the Kakuma refugee camp in northern Kenya to accommodate the influx of refugees fleeing violence in South Sudan. Nearly 50,000 people have fled to Kenya over the past year and a half.
That's Hilary Hewler reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up. Also in the news, an Islamic State militant linked to an attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Libya 3 years ago has been killed. And Rwanda's intelligence chief, General Karenzi Karaki, has been arrested in Britain. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Algeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. The U.S. government says an Islamic State militant linked to an attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Libya 3 years ago has been killed in an airstrike in Mosul, Iraq. The Pentagon says today that Ali Awin al-Harzi, who died in the June 15th airstrike, was a person of interest in the death of U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, in 2012. The U.S. Treasury and State Departments listed al-Harzi as a terrorist and a major link between North African extremists and the Islamic State in the Middle East. Following another airstrike in eastern Libya last week, the Pentagon confirmed the deaths of four other extremists linked to the 2012 attack in Benghazi. The United Nations is expanding the Kakuma refugee camp in northern Kenya to accommodate the influx of refugees fleeing violence in South Sudan. As Hilary Hewler reports from Nairobi, nearly 50,000 people have fled to Kenya over the past year and a half.
It was once home to the so-called lost boys fleeing war in what was then a united Sudan. Now, the sprawling refugee camp in Kakuma, Kenya, is set to grow once more to accommodate the swelling population of South Sudanese escaping their new country's civil war. UNHCR spokesman Emmanuel Nyabera says that before the conflict erupted in 2013, thousands of refugees were being repatriated and the camp was shrinking.
For a while, we thought that the population of refugees was going down, but then the new conflict that started in 2013 changed the landscape. Since then, we've had almost 50,000 new arrivals. So we have to prepare ourselves to make sure that we decongest the camps in Kakuma.
Nyabera says the camp, currently home to around 180,000 refugees, is now well over its capacity. The planned new site should be able to accommodate 80,000 people, many of whom will be moved from the current site to relieve overcrowding. There are around 17 nationalities in Kakuma, says Nyabera, including Somalis, Eritreans, and Congolese refugees. But South Sudanese now make up the majority. For some, this isn't their first stay in Kakuma refugee camp. Many had been repatriated, only to flee again once the newest conflict began. South Sudan's war has pitted forces loyal to President Salva Kiir against rebels supporting former Vice President Riek Machar. Despite several failed peace deals, the violence has escalated. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, recently reported that at least 129 children were killed in a government offensive last month, and rights groups have accused both sides of atrocities against civilians. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
Rwandan officials have confirmed that the government's intelligence chief, General Karenzi Karaki, has been arrested in Britain. Rwanda's Justice Minister, Johnston Busenge, has told VOA that Karaki has been arrested and the government is seeking clarification from Britain on the reason for the arrest. Busenge said he is expecting more information and clarification from the United Kingdom. He said his government is working with the relevant institutions to find out exactly what is going on. British authorities say Karaki was apprehended on a European arrest warrant on behalf of Spain, where he is wanted in connection with war crimes against civilians. Rwanda's foreign minister, Louis Mushikiwabo, protested the arrest on Twitter, saying Western solidarity in demanding African is unacceptable. She called the arrest an outrage. Busenge said General Karaki was attempting to board a plane at a London airport when he was detained. He said Karaki is expected to appear in court on Thursday. Karaki is one of 40 current or former high-ranking Rwandan military officials named in a 2008 Spanish indictment for alleged war crimes. Those indicted are accused of reprisal killings after the country's 1994 genocide. The accused are charged with genocide, crimes against humanity, and terrorism, resulting in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of civilians, some of them Spanish citizens. In Nigeria, civil defense workers say an estimated 30 worshippers died in suicide bombings yesterday afternoon in the largest city in the embattled northeast. Two teenage girls walked through a fish market in Maiduguri and blew themselves up outside a mosque during afternoon prayers in celebration of Ramadan. Yesterday's bombings continue a recent series of suicide bombings and attacks by armed extremists. Nigeria and a regional force from four neighboring countries have begun to push Boko Haram extremists out of several cities in Nigeria's northeast. A spokesman for Sierra Leone's National Ebola Response Center, NERC, in Freetown says health officials are concerned with the discovery of two new cases of the Ebola virus in the capital city. The news has caught health officials who thought they were defeating the disease by surprise. Sidi Yaya Tunis of the NERC says all Ebola treatment centers in the capital had been closed because no new cases have been found for several weeks. The news is a reversal of the downward trend in a disease that killed more than 13,000 in Sierra Leone in more than a year. The two cases occurred in one family living in Magazine, a densely populated poor community with minimal health services. A fisherman in the family contracted the virus from a girlfriend in Port Loko. During the week ending June 20th, the World Health Organization had reported 14 cases in the Cambia and Port Loko areas of Sierra Leone. Neighboring Guinea reported 10 cases during the same week. Liberia has been Ebola-free since May 9th. While progress has been made to preserve endangered animal, plant, and other species, a new report says successes are being overshadowed by declines. The International Union for Conservation of Nature warns many species face lethal threats. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The IUCN is the world's oldest and largest global environmental network. It has more than 77,000 species on its red list and warns that nearly 23,000 of them are threatened by extinction. Some 830 are listed as being extinct. The list indicates how fast the world is losing biodiversity. Craig Hilton Taylor, head of the organization's Red List Unit, says humans have been getting better at preserving species.
Yes, we have. We have built up quite a good set of tools and techniques for conserving species and their habitats. We know in many cases what we should do and how to do it. We are constantly surprised, though, by new emerging threats which take us by surprise. But after some research and hard work, we soon work out ways of dealing with the new threats as they emerge.
Buddy says knowing what to do is not the issue. The Red List points out where to take action and what species are at risk.
The big issue really is to try and get enough people and resources to actually do something about it, to get the governments to have enough political will to invest in conservation and also engaging in the general public as well. So it cuts across all levels of society.
One of the big conservation success stories is the Iberian lynx in Spain. there were just 52 mature cats in 2002. Today, there are 156. It may not seem like a lot, but it's enough to remove the Iberian lynx from the critically endangered list. Another example is the Guadalupe fur seal. It was twice thought to be extinct. There were 20,000 in 2010. On the other hand, 99% of the tropical Asian slipper orchids, a prized ornamental plant, are threatened with extinction. That's due to a huge illegal trade in the slipper orchids and habitat loss due to development.
Most people around the world, if they know orchids, they will either be growing them or will have seen them or had them in their houses, cut flowers. They are truly spectacular flowers.
And then there's the African lion. It's on the IUCN's vulnerable list.
The lion story is quite complicated because lions in southern Africa are pretty well conserved. Most of them are in protected areas. There's good conservation policies in place to protect lions in southern Africa. And so, in fact, the southern African population is increasing. But as soon as you move up into East Africa or across to West Africa, it's a totally different picture. The lions in West Africa are completely isolated from the rest of African lions. This is critically endangered.
The lions face habitat loss, poaching, and conflict with humans. Prey animals are on the decline in some areas, causing lions to kill livestock. Hilton Taylor says the International Union for Conservation of Nature takes a slow approach before declaring a species extinct.
So, for example, one of the species on the list this time was a species of orchid from Madagascar. It was last seen in 1898, over 100 years ago. But we still don't declare it extinct because there's still little patches of forest that haven't been surveyed properly. There's a remote chance it may still be living on a treetop somewhere that we just haven't looked at. So it takes a long time to declare something extinct.
A recent study in the Journal of Science Advances says the sixth mass extinction in the Earth's history has begun. The study, like the IUCN, says humans are the driving force behind unprecedented extinction rates. For example, since 1900, nearly 480 vertebrate species have gone extinct. The IUCN says no new species have been declared extinct, but 14 have been assessed as critically endangered.
The whole acceleration of the extinction is very much a human factor. So it's demand for land for agriculture, building cities, roads, extraction of mineral has huge impacts, pollution events. So there's a whole lot of different activities from people that reduce population sizes, reduce ranges, that has impacts on these species and drive them towards extinction.
Hilton Taylor says environmental legislation can help preserve species, but he says much more needs to be done to protect habitats.
We can go around and set areas of land aside as protected areas, as national parks or as nature reserves, and make sure that those networks are well connected to each other so species can move between different areas. But you can't conserve all the land. You have to look at how we manage the land outside of the protected areas. So putting into place effective management and restoration projects to restore habitats and ecosystems back to how they were before.
He says sometimes farmers need to be compensated not to cultivate their land and allow the natural habitat to remain. This was done to save the Iberian lynx. And sustainable fishing methods may help save gobies, one of the largest families of marine fish. Many of their coral reef homes have disappeared, and they are more vulnerable to invasive lionfish. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
An extraordinary conference of the Organization for Wildlife Conservation in Africa and the 15th meeting of the 10-member Congo Forest Basin has ended in Yaoundé with a statement of intent to save Africa's wildlife, whose future, the ministers say, is threatened. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Jeff Dupin, director of the African Wildlife Foundation that works together with the people of Africa to protect wildlife and wild lands, says poaching has become a multi-billion dollar illegal wildlife trade with devastating consequences for elephants and large animals in the Congo Basin, one of the world's richest biodiversity areas.
There is the slaughter of the elephants going on, losses of populations of great apes and of many other mammals. The creation of those protected areas might have decreased the loss to a certain extent. We can't say that we're winning the battle right now. Whether this has to do with national security, whether this has to do with poaching, whether this has to do with livelihoods, well-being of the local communities, you need a diversity of partners. Working together with the African people to secure the future of the African wildlands and wild mammal animals. Because if we don't act more powerful, the situation will become desperate.
Gert Paulinus of the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network says the massive slaughter of elephants for ivory became an international concern when armed Janjaweed groups from Sudan began killing the animals for ivory to fund their activities.
Ammunition of war and the sophistication of the criminals and the networks they have created. 62% of the elephants in Central Africa have been lost. The black rhinoceros of Central Africa is now extinct. Those are two factors that indicate the seriousness of the problem.
The Congo Basin is the second largest tropical rainforest on Earth. Its rich and diverse ecosystem provides food, fresh water, and shelter for millions of people, spanning 251 million hectares from Central African countries through the Atlantic Ocean's Gulf of Guinea to the mountains of the Albertine Rift. Professor Zach Chunje of the International Center for Research in Agroforestry says the killing of wildlife and unsustainable exploitation of the Congo forest is taking a toll on the entire natural resources of the basin.
If the landscape is not there, the wildlife will go. If the wildlife is not there, all that thing will lost. So we need really to protect all the biodiversity and protect our environment and protect our forests and reconstitute our forests.
During the meeting in Yaoundé, concerns were raised that many illegal hunters collaborate with the local population who are basically poor and vulnerable. John Farr, professor of biodiversity and human development at Manchester Metropolitan University, says there is a growing need to empower communities in the Congo Basin.
Generally, people are eating porcupine, people are eating rats. These are very productive species. These are species that can actually do very well wherever you put them. So what we're saying is that there are some species that can be hunted sustainably for the benefit of people, but the protector, the large species like elephants, the great apes, and even some primates, some monkeys, are better not touched.
Cameroon's Minister of Wildlife, Ngole Philip Ngwese, says Africa needs to rally behind the May 2015 African-led strategy and action plan to combat the illegal trade of the continent's natural resources drawn up in Congo-Brazzaville. Professor John Farr blames China.
The problem that we have with elephants nowadays is the fact that China is the main country buying the ivory that comes out of Africa. So the Chinese have to take this on board and say, you know, we are responsible as well for this, and we shouldn't be actually supporting the sale or the buying of ivory.
The Congo Basin Forest Partnership of countries and groups working for the conservation is home to three of the world's four species of great apes. There are approximately 10,000 species of tropical plants in the basin, and 30% are unique to the region. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A unique organization in Addis Ababa aims to empower women with disabilities. The Ethiopian Women with Disabilities National Association is headed by Brahane Daba, who also helped to start the organization. Brahane contracted polio as a small child and spent several years crawling on two blocks of wood in her village in Guntuta. A Peace Corps volunteer took her up to a surgeon in Addis Ababa who corrected most of her problems. She became a data analyst until she retired to run her organization. Brahane received the Harris Wofford Global Citizen Award from the National Peace Corps Association in Berkeley, California this month. VOA's Kim Lewis talked to her about her organization and what it is like to be a role model for other women with disabilities.
Women with disabilities have a double discrimination in the society, and I am physically disabled, and I know a lot of things faces in my country. So me and my friends, we were aid to establishing this association in Addis Ababa first, and we have to establish again 5 branches in the region.
What kind of discrimination do women go through with disabilities in Ethiopia?
In terms of gender and also of their particular disability, and they live poverty in the country, the disability face triple discrimination for relation to gender and disability.
What types of services do you offer women with disabilities?
Mostly we are working with advocating the issue of women with disabilities to be equal partners and give different awareness raising programs of the members and their families through training to prepare discussion of support program for women with disabilities in my association and build capacity for women with disabilities, like training on small business skill, vocational skill and entrepreneurship, some others. And we provide psychosocial support services for women, especially for self-esteem development for women. You know, they are mostly have some psychological problem because of the family are neglected this woman with disability. That's why we needed to continue to provide psychosocial support and provide training, life skill training and reproductive health, HIV AIDS also. We expand in the association from the region. We are working with the government, especially working with social ministers.
How is your organization funded?
We get funds from different organizations, especially we get some small grants from the government, and also we get from Belize, they are from Finland, and we get small grants from ILO, and we get small grants from different places.
Also, just to put you in the spotlight here just for a few seconds, you recently received on June the 6th an award. It was the Harris Wolford Global Citizen Award from the National Peace Corps.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that and how you feel about that?
I'm so glad and I'm so happy about this award. This is also the recognition for our work and also recognition for women with disabilities in general in my country. And, you know, we are a lot of things in my country and we have trying to do something, but still we have not got any recognition. And, you know, the misconception is everywhere in my country. We have to do something by ourselves, but people are not recognized. This award is give more recognition and focusing on the people with disabilities in general, also supporting that disability is not inability.
Your organization now has a membership of 3,000 women.
3,000, yeah.
And it's growing. So what would you say is the biggest thing that inspires women or empowers them?
They need equal opportunity in the country because women and disability are double and triple discrimination. This is for our organization is so struggling for this huge number to equal opportunity for women with disabilities. And also we are to make inclusion in the society for making inclusion for women with disabilities in general.
Brahane Daba is director of the Ethiopian Women with Disabilities National Association in Addis Ababa. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Washington, D.C. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have a native computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. The 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music.
No clouds in my stones.
Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. An Islamic State militant linked to an attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Libya 3 years ago has been killed. Nearly 50,000 people from South Sudan have fled to Kenya over the past year and a half. Rwanda's intelligence chief has been arrested in Britain. And coming up, we'll have music from Algeria and in our feature segment, a conversation with a Ghanaian-born fashion model. And now chairman and CEO of the Tigray Mining Group. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are tipping off in South Sudan.
Kim, we're going to tip off in Juba, the capital of South Sudan, where a Manute Bol Memorial Basketball Tournament is being played this week. Organizers and players say the competition is not only keeping alive the legacy of Bol, who died 5 years ago, but also spreading messages of peace and developing South Sudan's basketball talent. Reporter Magumi Davis Walker-Ringe tells us more from Juba.
The theme of the Manute Bol Tournament is Sports Unite Us. The event features South Sudan's four leading teams, Malakia Basketball, the National Engineering Sports Club, Black Stars Basketball Club, and Imlatalata Basketball Club. Nicola Bol is Manute Bol's cousin. He played on Sudan's national basketball team between 1968 and 1988. He says he hopes this inaugural sporting event in memory of his famous NBA player will give South Sudanese a brief respite from 18 months of conflict.
We need our people to wipe their eyes from tears and to be happy for one day or two, for this whole week, to be together. And we hope that this will make bridge among the, and we bridge the boundaries between the tribes and sectionalism and all things that divide us from each other.
Nicola Bol says the important life lessons take away from what happens on a basketball court.
If somebody aggresses you, you try to forgive him. And that is how it is. In basketball, if you get an elbow and you got an apology from your teammate or your colleague, you say, sorry, no problem. We go ahead.
27-year-old Abraham Salva Mathok plays for the Black Stars. His team defeated Nimnatalata by a score of 68-45 in the first game of the tournament. But Mathok says there is more to the tournament than winning or losing a game of basketball.
This tournament is truly a positive thing, and it contributes to our nation's unity. So I'm actually proud to be a part of it, and it can actually contribute to our unity. Yeah, Manute Bol was a great man, and he's definitely done a lot for our people. So us as the youth coming together and doing something for Manute Bol to recognize his accomplishments is our small way of showing that this man is truly a great man.
Bol played in the NBA for 10 years. From 1985 to 1995, for the former Washington Bullets, now known as the Wizards, the Philadelphia 76ers, the Miami Heat, and the newly crowned NBA champions, the Golden State Warriors.
Nice one from Kellerman. Nice score from Kellerman.
Ayel Marwal Lake, who goes by the name Awilo, was chosen as the most valuable player for scoring 14 points for Nimlatalata. 25-year-old Lake says Manute Bol was inspiration when he started playing basketball at age 12. Today he hopes to inspire other children to take up the sport and excel at it.
Wish every kid to enjoy basketball, to play, and we need South Sudan people in peace, people to come to the sport and play basketball, and we need to compete in every tournament in the world. For me, I wish, and I'll be working it hard to be best player in the world.
Robert Ladu Benjamin is chairman of the South Sudan Basketball Association. He says that 5 years after Ball died, at the age of 47, the 7'7" basketball star continues to inspire many South Sudanese.
So he's a symbol that person, whether from the town or countryside, could make it if he's determined.
Manute Ball is remembered not only for his skills on the basketball court, but also for the charitable work he did for the people of South Sudan. To acknowledge his contribution, USAID and other partners helped construct a basketball court in the remote village of Turarey, where Ball was born. Event organizers say they are already planning for future Manute Ball tournaments and will invite teams from neighboring countries and some of Ball's former NBA teammates to take part in them. VOA. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
This is Dikeme Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
You need to get to the net. Thanks to Kembe. And this reminder for our VOA basketball fans, the Congolese giant Dikembe Mutombo will be officially enshrined in the Basketball Hall of Fame on September 11th in the eastern U.S. city of Springfield, Massachusetts. In more basketball news, host Nigeria swept the men's and women's senior titles at a 3-on-3 regional tournament in Lagos. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, has more details for us.
Hosts Nigeria won most accolades at the 3-on-3 FIBA Africa Zone 3 basketball tournament, which ended in Lagos on Sunday. Nigeria beat Ivory Coast 17-13 in the senior men's final, while Ghana outplayed Togo 18-14 in the bronze medal playoff. In the senior women's event, Nigeria outclassed Togo 21-9 in the final, while Benin dismissed Ghana 13-7 to claim third spots. Liberia pipped Ivory Coast 14-13 to triumph in the under-18 boys final, as Togo edged Nigeria 13-11 to clinch the bronze medal. Nigeria beat Benin 13-3 to win the women's under-18 final, and Togo clinched the bronze medal in the three-way contest. The event attracted teams from Benin, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Liberia, Senegal, Togo, and Nigeria.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Turning to athletics, Moroccan Amin Lalou clocked 3 minutes and 38.09 seconds to win the 1500 meters at the Bilbao International Meet in northern Spain on Sunday. Djibouti's World Junior Silver Medalist Abdi Waiz Muhyiddin was second in a lifetime best of 3 minutes and 38.46 seconds. Moroccan Younis Esalhi prevailed in the men's 3000 meters, while Ethiopians Buse Diribe and Zwednesh Ayele triumphed in women's 3000 meters and 3000 meters which is respectively.
Turning to football, the quarterfinal field at the Women's World Cup in Canada is nearly set, with only one round of 16 match left to play. That match will take place later Tuesday night, and will feature world champion Japan facing off against the Netherlands. The winner will play Australia in the quarterfinals on Saturday. Round of 16 action Monday saw England come back from one goal down to defeat the Grasshoppers of Norway 2-1 in Canada's capital city of Ottawa. Lucy Bronze beat Norwegian goalkeeper Ingrid Hjelmseth with a beautiful strike from outside the box for the game-winning goal with 14 minutes left, and send the three Lionesses to a quarterfinal matchup with host Canada. Later on Tuesday night in the Western Canadian city of, on Monday night in Edmonton, the world number two USA defeated Colombia 2-0. Colombia was without starting keeper Sandra Sepúlveda, who received a second yellow card in the final group stage match against England. Backup keeper Catalina Perez played well in the first half, but she received a red card just minutes into the second half when she took down U.S. striker Alex Morgan on a clear breakaway. Although the American women did not convert the ensuing penalty kick, Colombia was unable to maintain their solid defensive form with only 10 players. Morgan scored for the USA just 3 minutes later to give them the lead. After the game, Alex spoke about the team's struggles in the first half and the importance of getting a goal early after the break.
In the first half, it was really hard for us to break through their defense. So in the second half, after getting that PK and not converting, you know, we knew we had the momentum behind us. And thank God that we got it a little earlier, because if it was going to be down to the last 10 minutes, then you know Colombia was going to use some tactics to slow the game down. So I'm really happy I got that goal.
Alex Morgan wasn't the only one who was thrilled about scoring, as U.S. fans across the world celebrated a rare goal for their team in this tournament. The U.S. offense has not looked very dangerous at this World Cup after being held scoreless against Sweden and managing only one goal against 10-woman Nigeria. But the Americans still have plenty of reason to believe they can win the Cup, as they have one of the best defenses in the tournament. Goalkeeper Hope Solo and a back line led by veteran Allie Krieger have not allowed a goal since the 27th minute of their opening group stage game against Sweden, a total of 33 minutes played without conceding a goal. Carly Lloyd added the USA's second goal from the penalty spot in the 66th minute against Colombia to secure the USA's advancement to the quarterfinals. They'll play China on Friday, but the American women will be without midfielders Megan Rapinoe and Lauren Holliday, who will both be serving one-game suspensions for receiving their second yellow cards of the tournament against Colombia. Finally, former world boxing champion Oscar De La Hoya says he's very serious about a possible return to the ring. The 42-year-old De La Hoya told ESPN.com that the chances of him fighting again are 50-50. The Golden Boy hasn't fought since December 2008, when he was knocked out in the eighth round by Manny Pacquiao in a welterweight bout in Las Vegas, Nevada. Oscar De La Hoya lost four of his last seven bouts to end his prize fighting career. He says if he does make a comeback, he'd like to fight middleweight champion Gennady Triple G Golovkin or have a rematch against undefeated welterweight champion Floyd Mayweather, who beat De La Hoya by split decision in 2007. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a conversation with Ghanaian-born fashion model. And next, a new project to give Nigerians a resource for offline viewing at no cost. But first, some music. Here is Bilal from Algeria with Chiriki. يهضروا وجوه الميزيرية اللي نصهم جيعان يهضروا اللي ياكلوا الجلفان شريكي استالا بيستان يا شريكي شريكي دنيا غداران شريكي اللي قلب باكيطان يا شريكي شريكي الناس هداران شريكي استالا بيستان يا شريكي شريكي دنيا غداران
حقيقتان شريكي شريكي نسها الداران دبر راسك نافيقي شريكي اللي قطير نسيتني عامل كل شي بالحبات كل شي تيخي ولا كل شي بالفاني دبر راسك نافيقي شريكي اللي قطير نسيتني ولا كل شي بالحبات كل شي تيخي ولا كل شي بالفاني شريكي استلا بيستان شريكي شريكي دنيا غداران شريكي اللي قباكي طان شريكي شريكي الناس هداران شريكي استلا بيستان شريكي شريكي دنيا غداران شريكي اللي قباكي طان
بلال from Algeria with شريكي.
Well, she was a model strutting the catwalks in the latest Madu fashion trends. Today, Tigandanke Kamara is the chairman and CEO of the Tigay Mining Group and Kamara Gold and Mining Network. So how did this Ghanaian-born fashion model turn into a mining magnet? She recently visited Washington and spoke to reporter Lenore Madu.
Tigay Mining Group is the most and foremost holding. So mining is just a part of our different activities. And the other ones are, for example, agriculture. We are a little bit in the fishery, in the oil and energy. So, but for now, we are more likely focused on the mining part, which we are trying to expand. We already have licenses in Guinea in the gold and diamond. We actually put out a demand for iron ore, which we are still waiting for approval. In the meantime, we are now settled in the Ivory Coast and under Tigay Mining Group Côte d'Ivoire, so TMGCI, and we are starting Semaia Industrial.
You were a former model. Yes. Now you are a mining entrepreneur.
Yes.
What did it take for you to make that switch?
What it took is that while I used to model, sometimes, you know, modeling, it's everything is now clothing, it's jewelry. So I had few friends in the jewelry business. And it happened that most of them had licenses in Guinea or the mineral that they were using were coming from Africa and specifically Guinea. And then coming also from a political background, I've also known that mining in Africa, it's like a cornerstone for development. Then I also noticed that at that time, there were not so many women. Mm-hmm. If there were, they were not vocal.
For someone who is interested in this business but has no clue, where do you start?
What I did is to surround myself with people that know about the mining sector. And then I started with the local. So I have geologists, senior geologists, that have a very great, you know, broad knowledge of the mining sector in Guinea. And then they were able to guide me as far as the type of mineral that I should start with. And then where are the zones in Guinea? For example, when we talk about diamond, we have the diamond triangle in Guinea that's called the Kissidougou, Kerewane, Masanta. So it's important to be in those zones in order to get the quality of gems that you really want.
What type of challenges have you met?
First, being a young woman with a modeling fashion background. So it was very difficult for people just to look at me and then see me first as a businesswoman. Second challenge was raising funds. You know, because I went into business when the world economy has just shifted badly. And the area I invested, Guinea, at that time was going through some turmoil of its own. But thank God we elected a democratic president. Things started to be okay. The Ebola outbreak came in.
Let's talk about some misconceptions that people may have.
At some point, we had the problem about blood diamond. Some people were going to Africa using the minerals to afterward use that money to finance either war in Africa or elsewhere. So that was a big problem. But then they put in place the Kimberley process, mm-hmm. which helps a little bit now put some type of regulation and a structure in the diamond industry. Most of the time, they think that most mining magnates just don't really care about, population. Yes. They're there is to make their money and out. But in most cases, I cannot blame them, really, because if you don't, the governments don't put in place a structure which will protect the resource of the continent or of their regions, business is business.
So you think the main responsibility lies within the government to ensure that corporations are exploring, but yet also spreading the wealth to the locals?
For example, governments have laws that will impose on companies to have a social program.
Corporate social responsibility.
Yes. Exactly. I'm a daughter of Africa, you know, so it may be business, but at the end of the day, I want to see my continent succeed. I want to be able, through my activities, bring back something, give back something.
Tigangante is the chairman and CEO of the Tigai Mining Group. She was speaking with reporter Lenore Madu.
In Nigeria, more than 100 million people are not connected to the internet because of poor infrastructure, and on the few networks that offer this service, it's expensive and unreliable. A new project has come up to give people, especially university students, a resource for offline viewing at no cost. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Zaria, northern Nigeria.
What we have in front of you now is e-granary. You understand?
Yeah. A computer instructor in Ahmadu Bello University in Zaria, northern Nigeria, is taking a first-year student through the use of an offline library. The offline e-granary digital library is an innovative technology developed by a US-based non-profit organization called the WiderNet. The offline library provides digital educational resources to institutions like Ahmadu Bello University, which lacks adequate internet access. Kasa Mathias, head of the database unit of the university, says the students can access tens of thousands of educational materials without much problem.
We are interested in sensitizing our students, especially undergraduates. We give them the background information on the available databases that they can use for their research work, their assignments, especially projects, yes, and sometimes to even carry them through sensitized on new databases are available for them.
First-year student of archaeology Ibitoye Idowu says easy access to university reading material, documents and journals has made learning easy for him.
You find some website that you can't get enough information. Some information are just even off what you are looking for. Now, even it makes reading easier for me. Just coming down here, I'll be able to get what I want and go through it. I will understand even better because it's not every lecturer that knows how to really express what he has.
The innovation puts millions of digital academic documents, multimedia work, and websites onto a server in the university. The information is then available to students at no cost, whether there is internet or not. The students' hunger for reading material might be met for now, but still there are complaints about power outages.
So it wants to stabilize, so the thing goes off. But it's not a problem. We are sorry, but it's one of those challenges that we always have.
As Matthias was taking a student through the process of accessing information without the internet, power went off. The student, Idowu, spoke of his frustration.
The only challenge I'm having here is the power supply. Sometimes it will just go off, and sometimes it will just come about 5 times consecutively like that. It will just be going off. Yeah, it seems very, very frustrating sometimes.
The head of the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department, Professor Mohamed Mwazu, says his institution has spent heavily on access of information made readily available for 40,000 students and staff at the university. The offline digital library, founded in 2001, is connected in more than 1,000 schools, clinics and universities in Africa, Southeast Asia and many other countries. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Zaria, northern Nigeria.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More people than ever before are in need of humanitarian aid. Today, some 100 million, 51 million of them refugees from war and persecution, are in need of assistance, stretching humanitarian aid agencies to the breaking point. It is becoming increasingly clear that the patchwork humanitarian system that has evolved over the past 70 years is struggling to handle the burden of today's crises, said permanent representative to the United Nations Samantha Power. Speaking at the U.S. Global Forum on Improving Humanitarian Action, Ambassador Power said that although some reform has already taken place, the future of humanitarian aid is yet to be invented. And on that account, four key elements, security, modernity, dignity, and money, must be included in the conversation. Security is a top priority. Peacekeepers and humanitarians can together deliver critical aid and protection to tens of thousands of people, said Ambassador Power. Better security means a better environment for humanitarian work, less violence, and a greater likelihood that families can return to their homes and feed themselves, freeing more resources to tackle other challenges. Modernization, finding innovative ways to approach old problems, can strengthen humanitarian assistance. So, for example, the use of behavioral economics and behavioral science has helped us better understand why people do or do not take their medication on time, or what it takes to convince parents that sending their girls to school is a smart investment. Because a wounded soul may hurt as much as a wounded body, as the late UN envoy Sergio Vieira de Mello once said, finding ways to allow refugees and displaced persons to keep their dignity is all important. How can we ensure that humanitarian responses empower people affected by crises to have greater voice and greater choice? Asked Ambassador Power. And finally, the humanitarian community must find a way to get more countries to fund humanitarian action, to bring in the private sector and make the donation process cheaper and easier. Given the enormity of the suffering in the world and the inadequacy of our tools to ease it all, it is easy to feel despair, said Ambassador Power. I'm reminded of the Shakespeare line from The Tempest, "Hell is empty and all the devils are here." But she said to the gathered humanitarian community that the energy in the room convinced her that members of the humanitarian community are going to outmaneuver and prevail against the devils who inflict suffering and fuel displacement and conflict.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.